Hi, I'm Warren Giroux, Senior Investment Consultant with Sightline Wealth Management. We are bringing you a series of conversations with a select group of alternative investment managers Sightline works closely with. These managers specialize in private debt, private mortgages, long and short equity strategies, among others. As part of the discussion, we will touch upon governance, transparency, portfolio positioning, current strategy trends, and future opportunities in the asset class. Good morning. I'm Warren Giroux of Sightline Wealth Management. Today we have Chris Volks, the VP Investor Relations for Third Eye Capital, the sub-advisor to the Nine Point Tech Private Credit Fund. Welcome, Chris. We're glad you're able to join us today. Let's start with the portfolio construction. What the current AUM is of the fund, what the AUM of Third Eye is, how many loans are in this particular fund, the Nine Point Tech Fund, what the distribution is as far as geographic and so forth.
Great, thank you, Warren. So the fund, the Nine Point Third Eye Capital Private Credit Fund's AUM, and these figures are as of the end of the first quarter, April 30th figures to follow in short order. But the AUM at the end of the Q1 2021 for the Nine Point Third Eye Capital Private Credit Fund is $1.32 billion. The firm, so Third Eye Capital is a firm, advises to, manages directly, and has commitments of $2.7 billion as of the same quarter end. The fund, I'll call it the fund hereafter, as opposed to the long-winded name.
Yeah.
The fund itself currently has 25 loans that it's participating in. Representative of 16 borrowers. So there are borrowers, obviously, with more than one loan facility in the fund. So 16 borrowers, 25 loans. And of those borrowers specifically, so of the 16, you have 13 that are performing as of the reporting date, and you have three borrowers that are in workout, in default, not performing, or as would be calibrated and quantified under the accounting standard of the fund, which is IFRS, they would be what's in the highest provisional loan loss reserve position, which is stage three. And typically, you've got a loan loss provision against the loan amount outstanding, just to give you some context around what does stage three mean and size of loan loss provision. It's approximately a 20% loan loss reserve against the loan amount outstanding for the borrower. So that's the current status. The run rate, maybe one last point. Run rate for the performance. I can tell you to end of April, as I have an estimated return, which I believe has been finalized. You're at April's return was flat, meaning it was just down 12 or 14 basis points in the negative. But year to date, inclusive of the first 3 months, it is up about 3.5%. Again, an aggregated return. I'm not picking on a particular class of units, but an aggregated return net of fees is coming in at about 3.5% year to date, including, and that's to the end of April.
Okay. So I got a question on the loans that are not performing or non-performing. Of those borrowers, do they have multiple loans or are they just single borrower or single loan borrowers?
Thank you, Warren. One of the three borrowers in workout has two loan facilities that are in workout. It actually has an aggregate in total four loan facilities, it's issuer 30 in the fund. However, only two of them, I shouldn't say only, but two of the four are in workout. Okay. And it's two other so there's four loans, if you will, in workout, three borrowers in workout, because the other two borrowers, it's just one single loan facility.
Okay. So, Chris, I'm just curious, how does that work when you have a borrower that has multiple loans and one, or in this case, maybe let's use this as an example. You have four loans with one borrower. Two are in workout, and the other two are, I would say, obviously performing loans. Right. So if you were, are these ABL loans? Are they asset backed? And if they are asset backed, would you go after the assets of these, of the backing? And if you do, does that, I mean, you have to make an assessment. How does that impact the running of the continuing running of the business and the performance of the additional loans? But how do you deal with that? How does that work?
Thank you. So yes, they are asset backed, asset based loans. All our loan facilities are, meaning that they're all backed by the key critical collateral, the drivers of the business. So be it variable or fixed assets, typically receivables, inventory on the variable side, self-liquidating by their very nature of one turning into the other, turning ultimately into cash on the receivables and inventory side. And then you've got the classic sort of fixed assets making up the collateral mix of our borrowers on the other side, if you will, of the equation, plant, property, equipment. Also included are cash, oftentimes, of the borrowers. We have not only blocked account arrangements, but we hold as collateral. And then more of an intangible, obviously, but we often have as part of the collateral backing the loans, intellectual property in some form. So that is typically, or not typically, it's always what is backing our loans. In the instance where there is a borrower with two, and I'll tell you the details of that borrower, it's the largest of the three borrowers in workout. It's got the largest quantum. It's two facilities, two of four facilities are, as I said, in workout. Yes, and it is backed as well by the primary asset, which are receivables. It's offtake. It's an Alberta-based energy upstream, midstream energy producer, whose primary assets are its mineral interests, its oil offtake that it sells, markets and sells, as well as, though it is, as I say, a midstream producer. So it also has its own infrastructure, which is not unique, but definitely a bonus to have those additional assets backing that particular loan facilities, plural. Now, yeah, worst case scenario, that is what, Warren, what we have to liquidate, to recover on, which is our objective always with every underwriting, the loan amount outstanding. That's what we have backing that. We've cushioned that further, just before I get back to what we're doing with this particular borrower. We've cushioned it further, as I've mentioned in prior calls, by ensuring that any commodity-based borrower, like issuer 30, that we ensure that their cash cost of production, so their production costs, are fully hedged. And right now, as I say, and we've been saying this for the last three quarters, as far out as the hedges go, so I think we're at September right now, 2021, we're greater than 70% in the money on those hedges. So another additional cushion that we have for, as they say, commodity, because of the cyclicality and cyclical nature of their very business. Now, with issuer 30 and its two of four facilities in workout, we are in the throes of, as we have the ability to do, and again, because of the unique nature in which we underwrite loans, restructure if we need to, as opposed to the final backstop, if you will, of liquidating assets to get recovery. In this instance, we're looking to restructure the business. And part of that is acquiring the assets that, in essence, we help fund the business, the CapEx we provided initially. But now under a company creditors arrangement act structure, we've been able to not only continue to run the business, insert our own president and CEO, who's an experienced oil patch executive, successful one, Daniel Jalbert, who's based in Calgary. So he's our boots on the ground in the company, continuing its operations and helping with the lifting of acquiring the assets that we formerly provided to the borrower, or helped finance, excuse me, the borrower, and placing them ultimately in a special purpose company that we formed to continue with operation of the business, obviously under a new moniker, All with the express purpose, though, of getting those original loan amounts outstanding. So it's the process of working with the Alberta Energy Regulator, and which has fully vested, I can tell you, the acquisition of the assets, the movement of the assets from currently issuer 30, which is where it's in the fund, over now to the special purpose company's facilities, which is issuer 42. I'm not trying to make this a twister map here of one issue or the other, but just to explain that that's the type, as opposed to liquidating assets, we're actually largely under the CCAA umbrella, we're able to, and working obviously with the regulator, we're able to get approval and acquire subsequently the assets of that borrower, which are performing for the most part, save for the two we're acquiring right now because they're not allowed to perform. But as soon as they're under our special purpose company's issuer numbers, 42, they will also be performing like the other two loan facilities that preceded it over to issuer 42.
So
that's the restructure. So what we've done, in essence, boil it down, is not liquidating the assets, of which we have more than, you know, more than twice the loan amounts, plural, outstanding. We've got that 2-to-1 buffer, plus the, as I said, the hedges that are in place. Mm-hmm. But we're actually, as opposed to liquidating those assets to get recovery, we're wanting to continue to grow the business, albeit in a different form, and temporarily with our own operating principle, if you will, in place, and Daniel, but ultimately to get recovery, kind of a 12 to, we're looking now, we've benefited certainly from a strong energy pricing environment recently. So revenues on the producing assets are continue to be strong, and we're excited about the movement of the last two pieces over in order to get everything working, all assets working, ultimately in 12 to 18, hopefully sooner than that, but 12 to 18 months to be able to, the exit here is an acquisition or consolidation of the business. So third eye to be running this long term.
Yeah. So what was the value what is the value of the two non-performing loans?
Yeah. So the actual, give you the details here as again, as of the end of March, just to be clear, and their representation to the fund's NAV. There we are right here. One more page. There we go. So you've got the two facilities that are not performing represent in aggregate, so I'm going to combine the two, 100 and just over 112 million Canadian of the fund, which again, just to reiterate, as of the end of March was 1.3, I think I said 1.32 billion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, less than 10%. And even combined with the other two non-performing borrowers, you're less than 13% of the fund that is in a workout position.
So I guess I had a question regarding the restructuring. I'm just wondering why management didn't do this previously to allow them to continue the performing on these loans. I mean, the revenue is there. The revenue flow is there. You're not selling any assets. You're just restructuring, putting it into a special purpose vehicle to, to allow these loans to be performing. So what was the difference? I mean, what happened there to have management get in so much trouble?
Yeah, it was, I don't know if trouble's the word I would use, but certainly the challenge. What was just that? It was the, you know, we're typically, when we fund, I guess the euphemism in horse racing circles would be that we're betting on the jockey and backing our capital with the horse, and the jockey being metaphor for the management team, and in this case, yeah, we had a jockey maybe fall off the horse or not even get the tack on the horse during the course, even though that was one of the key criteria of us funding the business in the first place. And it always is, right? It has to be this isn't a new venture. First of all, this is an experienced management team. and which again is true regardless of the issuer that we ultimately fund. But we had, we did have an issue with the jockey, and they looked to, they looked to compromise on the first lien position that we always look to secure and do secure on those key critical assets that make up the borrowing base of our loan facilities. So the availability of capital that we're providing. So there was a, again, without getting too deep into it, there was a rogue move, I guess, by the management team. And we, it forced our hand because it was going to compromise our position on the key collateral, which is the offtake, right? The oil, the Lake Edmonton Lake Sweet Crude. We pre-COVID, this occurred in either end of third or start of fourth quarter 2019. We invoked, if you will, the CCAA, the Company Creditors Arrangement Act, stay of bankruptcy protection for creditors. It's allowed for creditors owing greater than $5 million, which clearly these creditors, these borrowers do. And in order to affect movement away from the management team, be able to take over the assets. Again, not a hostile takeover, at least maybe perceived by the management team, who also went into the creditor bid process, interestingly, to acquire the assets, because it just because we asked to acquire them and have underwritten the ability to do so doesn't mean we're, you know, carte blanche given them when we decide. We had to go through, again, under CCAA, a creditor bid process. We were deemed to be the best bid. And is obviously we were granted rights in order to acquire the assets. So that's what occurred, Warren, in a kind of a cryptic, but, you know, trying to be protective shell here.
Sure. Yeah, I guess another question that some of the listeners might be wondering about is, how does this impact the distributions, or how on a current basis, even going forward basis? Because you're taking, I assume, based on what you said earlier, some loan loss provisions,
right,
which affect the NAV on an ongoing basis, but then you have the distributions, and I think a lot of our clients are concerned about distributions because they bought tech for income, and so how does this sort of, what's the impact, and going forward?
Yeah, there's, I mean, this obviously impacts currently the fund up to that, you know, 8 or 9% that isn't availing, obviously, distribution, those two particular loan facilities, where the other two are. I mean, the fund endeavors to, on a monthly basis, obviously, with investors that have elected to do so, pay out its return in the form of, in the form of income. The issue becomes there's some of it is unrealized, some of it is realized. I'm referencing, of course, there's two sides to the distribution equation as well, right? There's the pure income, the interest and fees that we get from our performing borrowers, right? Those 13 that are currently performing, as well, when we're able to monetize on that upside, that those warrants. And I'll tell you, with issuer 30, this is one we've just been speaking about, there's a significant amount of upside tied into the fund. So the equity, we'll call it, portion of the portfolio. But it is through, Warren, on a monthly basis, we endeavor to pay out for investors that have elected, as opposed to a drip plan, have elected to take their profit, if you will, monthly profit as income. It's from the performing loans that we look to pay that out. Now, sometimes, and we had occurrences in 2020 where that's offset. In other words, there isn't, although there's an ability to pay out, the NAV, the net asset value per unit grows for the investor. Sometimes there's other details within the fund. For example, any sort of FX hedges that are in place and the costs associated with them and any sort of sudden gyration between the US and the Canadian dollar, sometimes those fees and expenses can offset the fund's ability to pay out as much or sometimes even any distribution in question. I mean, last This, no, earlier than this time last year, at the start of COVID, say March of 2020, we had a situation where, you know, the fund was, it was still paid out a bit of a distribution, but it was in negative territory because of the mark that we were required to place on that equity associated primarily with issuer 30. Excuse me. And at the time, you may recall, we had the double headwinds of not only the onset of COVID and its effect on the business, plus you had non-performing facilities for issuer 30. Plus, there was a period there in late March, early April, where light sweet crude, specifically West Texas Intermediate, traded negative period of time. So you had all those headwinds. So what occurred was that for the fund is they had a large and very conservative equity reserve in place for potential loss on the equity associated with the fund. And that, for a period, diminished any opportunity for sort of an orderly, if you will, distribution payout for a period of time. But ongoing, although no guarantee, but those that elect for income, certainly we will endeavor to pay it out, all things being equal, based on obviously primarily interest and fees that we take monthly from our performing borrowers. That's predominantly where the distribution comes to be paid out.
So on a going forward basis, on your, when you actually entertain or take a look at a new loan, are you also adding primarily equity, or not primarily, are you adding equity kickers and warrants and so forth for upside potential? I know you've done that in the past, but is that becoming more predominant going forward?
Yeah, I'd say it's, excuse me, it's as predominant. I don't think it's any more predominant. Okay. There have been periods certainly where it's been easier to garner alignment. Not necessarily we've been able to monetize on that additional, those equity kickers, as you say, but we've always endeavored. And the reason being is because we're always, you know, when we, if you will, diagnose a prospective opportunity, a business that we look to lend working capital or capital for expansion to, we always, you know, because of our want to be involved and through that diagnosis, identifying something where based on our expertise, we can help and insert ourselves sometimes as far as running the business, but that's extreme. Typically it's operational improvements. It could be aid with implementing because of our experience, new enterprise resource planning modules, helping reduce receivables. But for all of that, we typically want to share in the growth, hopefully that turnaround or continued growth of the business. We want to share, we want to have investors share in that, ourselves being investors as well, Third Eye. Right now, Warren, all of the deals in our backlog, our new transaction pipeline, we call it, that have made that list, not all will be funded, but those that are in advanced stages of closing, I can tell you they all have a healthy, objective of alignment, consistent with what historically we've been able to garner. And that is, you know, we target a gross internal rate of return for our borrowers. This is general, but pretty close, of about 20%. Mm-hmm. And three quarters of that, or 15%, is typically comprised of the contractual interest and fee charges that are going to go through that 2 to 3 year term of the loan. Right? So that's that 11 to 15% portion. Mm-hmm. And then historically, not on all, but again, we look to through alignment, those kickers, be it warrants or bonus fees or some sort of sales participation or a royalty even, gather that other, if you will, 25%, or in that 20% total equation, the additional 5. And it's no different right now with the deals that are in our backlog, which represent approximately 220 million Canadian. For particular investments that are in advanced stages of closing. They don't comprise the full new deal pipeline, but I'm telling you about the, giving a little overview on the 4 that are closed. But they all have equity kickers structured to be included. Mm-hmm. Again, whether we can monetize, it's another story. And remembering too, that our target return for investors isn't based off of that gravy, we'll call it what we also call our execution premium, that alignment through our involvement, getting rewarded, having investors rewarded. It's all based off of the contractual interest and fees that we charge. So when I say our target return,
You know, we target net of fees, management performance fees. We target for investors, again, regardless if they've elected to take a distribution,
right,
all the profit or not, an 8 to 12 return on an annual basis. So that isn't wavering, or we're not wavering on that for 2021. We didn't achieve it in 2020, quite clearly. But we are back on track, I can tell you. And there's exciting opportunities, as I said, close in the pipeline to closing. And fortunately, we have the cash in the fund to be able to do so as well.
That leads me to another question. How much cash is currently in the fund available for new loan commitments?
Yeah, so we have, and again, I'll reference the end of March as far as details, but there is, of the fund's current AUM, 6% of the fund is sitting in cash. So, and that's after, you know, that's a net figure. That's after any redemption payouts, because it's part, obviously, of the NAV. 6% of that $1.32 billion is in cash.
Now, do you have a lending facility to enable you? Like you said, you had 220 in the pipeline. If you were to say, for argument's sake, I'm not saying you will or suggesting you will, but fund all of those loans of 220, right, you obviously don't quite have the cash available. So do you partner with someone else? Do you have a loan commitment or a credit line of credit, banking facility, anything?
Not a line of credit, but we do, as you alluded to, we do. We've always endeavored to, on a fair allocation basis, syndicate capital proceeds from all investor pools that we either advise to or have committed capital in. So yes, we have, so you're right. I mean, just quick math tells you the fund wouldn't be able to take all of that, and nor would we want the fund to. As I say, we look to, you know, fairly allocate all new investments across. Caveats, there has to be cash, first of all, in that fund, or there has to be committed capital in that closed-end fund to participate. And also the term of the loan has to be palatable with the fund itself, meaning that, you know, you've got 120 day liquidity on the fund. If you were to put a 48 month loan in that fund, that's a little bit of a difficult liquidity mismatch to swallow. So you wouldn't see a 48 month loan in the fund. It may only, if funded, may only be participating in one of our closed and longer liability, if you will, funds, whereas an eight-year term. But otherwise, yes, that's where we would get, or will get, if you will, because we do have available committed capital from other pools. I mean, we look at ourselves as one, it's one strategy, it's one pool, but we have to segregate simply because we have different investor types.
Yeah. I'm just curious what the geographic allocation, how much are in the U.S., how many loans are in the U.S. versus Canada? And you alluded to the fact that the hedging costs, this last year, the Canadian dollar has been quite strong. So your hedging costs must have been quite substantial, depending on what your commitment to the U.S. was and the payout from the U.S.
Yeah, as far as geography, you've got most of, consistent with history of our managing the strategy since 2005, you've got somewhere between 80 and 85% of the borrowers are based here. I'm not talking, this is just purely based on the domicile of the borrower, not based on a weighted issuance, if you will, loan facilities, because that would probably skew more into that. And well, it's still skewed to Canada, actually. You've got one large US based borrower, but yeah, so it's predominantly Canada. It's 85% of Canada. It continues to be, right? All the deals that we're looking at now are either based here, i.e. the operations of the businesses are based here, or if they are not based here, they historically continue to be south of the border. Our rest of the world has been where we understand and know it's been the United States to this point. And those introductions, or have been introductions through some sort of Canadian relationship. It could be a Canadian affiliate, or just a team that knows either a legal auditing agent that's worked on a past deal, current deal with us, that makes the suggestion to introduce us to a prospective U.S. borrower. But most of them are Canadian, as we sit
As far as the Warren, as far as the costs of FX, yeah, the attribution I can actually provide. I don't have it in front of me right now. I was trying to search for it as I was talking here, but we have an attribution breakdown which would tell you exactly how much of the return in 2020 was attributable or detracted from by FX costs. I know in 2019 it was quite minimal, but as you say, 2020, there was some significant gyrations. Yeah. Still, I have seen it, and it's still not. I mean, the predominance of the attribution does come from, interest and fees that we were able to collect from the performing borrowers, one recovery on a non-performer. And, the negatives would be, obviously what takes away the expenses would be FX.
Yeah.
And management performance fees predominantly.
So, I had another question and I just sort of slipped my mind. I wanted to know the distribution or the sector allocation. In other words, what you might have in energy or tech or healthcare or professional service business is what's the breakdown?
Industry allocation, yeah, you've got... I have an issuer breakdown, and it's not answering your question, but I do have somewhere I've got industry as well. I mean, as far as issuer, meaning borrower, you've got the largest borrower representing 19% of the fund's NAV as of the end of March. And then no one any larger than 14. And in fact, the average would be somewhere between 5 and 8 overall as far as the issuer. As far as industries, again, I don't have the actual breakdown. I can provide that for you. However, on a quick glance, I can tell you that, certainly there is a predominance in the energy arena, energy being not only the aforementioned upstream, midstream, late sweet crude producer, but also a natural gas producer. That's actually one of the other, it's about an 8% position. And if I throw in as well, two other issuers, one of which is an oil and gas servicing company, so not a direct, more inelastic investment, if you will, versus direct commodity fluctuated affected play, and an alternative energy producer. In fact, a longstanding, if you deem that energy, and you do, an ethanol producer. You've got, if I add those four together, you've got about 42% of the, currently 42% of the fund in energy. Again, to reiterate, it is not a macro call by Third Eye Capital to be that heavy, if you will, in the energy space. It just happens to be, based on our experience and the timing, that there were four businesses there that, one of which is, as I say, longstanding, where we could involve ourselves and help those businesses. And they happen to all fall with a energy or sustainability, if you will, attachment in the case of the alternative energy company. However, you've got a good cross-section of the other industries that historically we have funded as well. Everything from transportation to utilities to consumer non-durable and healthcare, all in the portfolio as well. And again, we are agnostic as far as our approach to businesses and what industry they're in. However, we've certainly developed expertise in, I would say, sort of 10, if you will, industries in this country specifically, and the US, where we see repeat deals because of our history and where we can add value, right? Because we've either worked in it as an operator or, as I say, because of our involvement with past boards in that same industry vertical, we're able to, pun intended, lend our expertise to those businesses to help them through our period of involvement.
So let's talk about the pipeline for a moment. How, given the interest rate environment, everybody's been talking about inflation and, what the Fed's going to do, what central banks are going to do regarding monetary policy and so forth and so on. How do you see that affecting your pipeline or what's the impact? Potential impact on your loan book, existing as well as future.
Yeah, sure. Right now, just to reiterate, as far as our pipeline, I don't think I said this I talked about the four deals that are close to closing in an aggregate of 220 million Canadian. You know, we are seeing an abundance of opportunity right now, even with the banks sort of pulling back on their, as you've seen them reverse a lot of the cautionary loan loss provision pools that they had in place during the last sort of 12 to 18 months. So their involvement back in lending is occurring. However, you know, our unique view and an approach of not only just the binary on-off switch of here's capital, pay us back, but also involvement to help a business, the consult, the guidance, continues to enable us to see a very unique deal flow set, origination set, opportunity set. And, you know, overall, we've got about 22 actually investments we are, including the four in advanced stages of closing, So another 18 that make up about $1.8 billion that are in our pipeline. So meaning that you've got a lot of opportunities that meet our investment criteria where there's at least some sort of indicative terms have been agreed to. As they say, they meet our criteria of good management, good assets that are marketable, that are fungible, that need be, as you were asking at the very outset, that if we had to, we could liquidate to be made whole. Good stakeholder, collegial, both internal and external supplier relationships, multiple exits to recovery, and a good business model, more importantly, and if an opportunity, although good, we can insert ourselves and help those businesses. So I bring that up to reiterate, those are our our key criteria, but all of the $2 billion in aggregate that we have in our pipeline right now all meets that. And we continue to see, because of what did occur with the credit dislocation, the banks not funding, and because of our unique approach, this first look deal set and larger deals as well. Your question, so larger meaning that the average size is between 75 and 100 million is what we're looking to underwrite right now. Your question though around potential and you know a rising, let's say, interest rate environment is interesting because it's not the first time, you know, in our 16 years that we've gone through that and could go through it and are going through it again. It also, it's interesting because of the fact that typically in lockstep with, say, rates either eking up or accelerating up, we've typically benefited, and how so is that inflation typically, you know, costs of goods typically goes up, obviously, in that period as well, meaning that the assets, again, those variable and fixed assets, backing our loans also accrete in value. So you've got, you know, a nice sort of backstop by asset values growing. And if need be, this is a key factor, specifically on revolving lines of credit, which is pretty much in every part of every loan facility that we have right at the moment. We can adjust because we underwrite each loan floating with a floor. So if rates go up, we can adjust rates accordingly. But as I say, it also happens to be that in lockstep, the assets backing, so in that 2-to-1 coverage, the value of those assets in the LTV, the value of the assets also accretes. So it's a nice sort of built-in buffer, if you will, in this kind of interest rate environment.
So I didn't ask you, and you brought it up about the LTV. So on average, what kind of LTV are you looking at loan to value when you execute a loan?
2-to-1. 2-to-1 is the end.
Okay.
Not on a percentage basis, 50% or less. And that's just on, just to be clear, Warren, that's just on the key critical assets that we develop our borrowing base from, our loan facilities from. So in other words, although we ring fence in essence and in reality, all the assets, you know, we have general security agreements and personal security agreements of which we are, you know, obviously primo on during the period of the loan, which don't have as much value quite frankly when, you know, but they're great for execution and negotiation and strength, a lever, if you will, if something does go sideways. You've certainly got the attention of the principles of the borrower. So that's there. But we also have other additional tertiary, boot, ancillary, whatever you want to call it, capital assets that we ring fence as well, that we put first lien on typically, not always, sometimes second lien, but first lien. So when you combine all of it, we have a much greater than 2-to-1 coverage to being 2x asset value to loan outstanding coverage for our facilities. I can tell you right now in the fund, we're a little above because you also include cash, right? As I said earlier, to the fixed assets, not with every borrower, but some that we have as part of the collateral mix is cash. Of course, cash, we don't need a 2-to-1 buffer there just because due to the very liquid nature of its essence. But I can tell you right now, the LTV on the fund, and this is just, in fairness, this is just the performing borrowers, mm-hmm. is, I believe, 64%. I'm just verifying that now. If you'll just bear with me. It is 64% as of the end of March. So a little below the 2-to-1. But again, there are some, especially larger borrowers, where cash is making up that LTV equation. And that, of course, would skew or lower, if you will, on a ratio basis.
Right. I think that pretty well covers most of the questions that I had. I just leave you with the parting remarks or comments. Is there anything that you think our listeners might be of value to our listeners regarding the space or Third Eye that you want to leave us with?
Yeah. Thank you, Warren. Well, as I said, we're quite excited as 2021 comes to its halfway mark. We're excited about being on track for that targeted return for investors. It's a much brighter outlook than, you know, obviously the challenging period this time last year that we were going through. So we're excited based on our opportunity set. We're excited as we are looking to, you know, as if not most importantly, recover on those non-performing borrowers, of which there are three. I talked about one in great detail. The other two, again, we're expecting, and as we do always, working towards 100% recovery on the loan amount outstanding to all borrowers, including those in workout. And we're optimistic and confident we're going to realize that. So we should hopefully start seeing some of that recovery for those three, some of it coming in the second half of 2021. That will augment return because we'll be able to reverse a portion, if not all, of the provisional loan loss reserves that are in place for those borrowers. So couple that with a strong pipeline set, good performance against the strong performing borrowers year to date. Yeah, it's an exciting opportunistic time, we feel. And maybe, you know, our yields aren't being compromised either. We touched on it earlier about our pipeline. We're not having, because of increased competition, because of banks coming back into the market, we're not seeing any compression on our contractual yield pricing. And why? It's because of the nature of the borrowers that we see and their understanding of the kind of added value that we can provide, the cost of that, and that cost won't offset any kind of growth, top line revenue that they're aiming to get. In fact, our involvement will only aid and abet. So great deal flow. Very confident about moving forward into second half of 2021. And thank you, everyone, for your continued support. And here for any questions that you have.
Well, thank you very much for that, Chris. Appreciate it. And until next time, all the best.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
All the best to you as well. Thank you.